From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Jesse Helms used the film Tongues Untied as an example of the left-wing bias of public TV. The Christian Coalition used the film to demonstrate why content restrictions were necessary for the National Endowment for the Arts. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Marlon Riggs about the controversy over his film Tongues Untied and how it's affected his life. And we'll hear about his new film, which will be shown Monday on public television. Also, returning home to find the town has been taken over by the military. We'll talk with journalist and novelist Francisco Goldman. He was born in Guatemala and raised in Boston. And in these days of massive layoffs, linguist Jeff Nunberg explores the euphemisms corporations have come up with to tell their employees they're fired. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The European Community and its member nations promised a down payment of more than $4 billion to start some of the environmental and development programs negotiated at the Earth Summit. NPR's Richard Harris reports from Rio.
For the past week and a half, diplomats have been negotiating the all-important details of an 800-page action plan designed to help developing countries protect the environment while improving their standard of living. The United Nations estimates that this plan will cost some $600 billion a year, and United Nations officials figure that $125 billion of that must come from the wealthy nations of the world. The nations of the European Community made a modest down payment with a $4 billion pledge, including some new funding and some that's essentially being relabeled. Canada and Germany also announced that they would forgive certain third world debts, and the United States said it would increase its foreign aid, too. It's been widely reported that Japan could be another big donor here. It's on the speech schedule for tomorrow. This is Richard Harris in Rio de Janeiro.
Organizers of a parallel Earth Summit in Rio said today that donations from around the world have solved a cash crisis that was about to shut them down. The parallel summit, known as the Global Forum, was set up to act as a bridge between non-governmental organizations and the official summit of world leaders. Creditors threatened to shut the event down unless it made up for a $2 million shortfall. The United Nations Development Program pledged $500,000, followed by sizable donations from Sweden, France, Germany, and Canada. About 30,000 people a day are taking part in the two-week meeting. Secretary of State James Baker and Russian Foreign Minister Andrei Kozyrev ended talks in London today, close to an agreement on making greater cuts in U.S. and Russian nuclear arsenals. NPR's John Idsty reports.
After their meeting, the two officials said there was a good chance that a final agreement could be reached next week when President Bush and Russian leader Boris Yeltsin meet in Washington. But Baker and Kozyrev refused to reveal any details of the progress they'd made. The two sides have been trying for months to codify proposals made by both leaders, offering to go beyond cuts agreed to in the START treaty signed last fall. That treaty allows each country to have up to 6,000 long-range nuclear missile warheads. The current talks aim to reduce the number to 4,700. The negotiations became thorny when the U.S. called for the banning of all land-based multiple warhead missiles, the backbone of the Russian arsenal. The Russians said that would leave the U.S. with an unfair advantage because it would leave untouched submarine-based nuclear missiles where the U.S. has superiority. I'm John Idsty in London.
Stock prices made a slight gain today in response to better-than-expected news on inflation. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained about 3 points to close at 3,354.36. This is NPR. Russian President Boris Yeltsin has acknowledged that American prisoners of war were held in the Soviet Union despite Soviet denials and left open the possibility that some may still be alive. Yeltsin made the acknowledgement in a written reply to U.S. senators investigating the fate of Americans missing from World War II, Korea, Vietnam, and Cold War incidents. The letter said that the Russians are investigating the fates of some crew members who may have survived from U.S. aircraft that were downed over the Soviet Union in the 1950s. The contents of the letter were made public today by the leaders of the Senate Select Committee on POW and MIA Affairs. New Hampshire today became the 13th state to place Ross Perot's name on its November ballot. Kathy McLaughlin of New Hampshire Public Radio reports.
About 150 supporters of the as-yet-undeclared candidate rallied in front of the State House in Concord. They included many Democrats and Republicans who voted earlier this year in the New Hampshire primary. Norma Rae McKinney of Mount Vernon says she's grown disillusioned with the slate of candidates.
We need a change, by golly. And I'll vote for this guy because all the rest of them have had a chance and they haven't proven anything to me.
It's a different political picture here now than 4 months ago when another candidate who billed himself as an outsider, Paul Tsongas, won the state Democratic primary and Republican Patrick Buchanan posted a surprisingly strong showing against President Bush. Perot's supporters gathered more than 10 times the required 1,500 signatures, guaranteeing the Texas billionaire a spot on the New Hampshire ballot this fall. For National Public Radio, I'm Kathy McLaughlin in Concord.
Perot supporters also succeeded in getting their candidate on the ballot in North Carolina today. Perot has already won spots in Arkansas, Tennessee, Utah, Delaware, Maine, Kentucky, Wyoming, Texas, Florida, New Jersey, Idaho, and Alaska. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the attacks against NEA funding of controversial art, and in the recent attacks against the funding of public broadcasting, Marlon Riggs' film Tongues Untied has been cited as an example of how taxpayers' dollars should not be spent. Last summer, the film was broadcast as part of the public television documentary series, POV. But nearly half of the stations that carried the series chose not to broadcast Tongues Untied. The film is about being black and gay in America. Either would be enough to shut you out of the American mainstream. Being gay can even make you an outcast within the African-American community. The film was hybrid in form, part autobiography, part documentary, part poetry, music, and performance. Marlon Riggs has a new documentary, which will be shown on the POV series Monday night. This one is about how primetime TV has represented African-Americans. We invited Marlon Riggs to talk with us about his new film, but first we wanted to hear how the Tongues Untied controversy has changed his life.
As you can imagine, one couldn't help but be changed by all of the craziness that occurred since the broadcast, in particular, of Tongues Untied. In some ways, it's been very positive, as you can imagine, though, because it really has drawn attention to issues of censorship, black gay life, which was the important motivation for the work. And also generally how certain forces in our society are using different kinds of work to attempt to consolidate their control over popular culture, including public broadcasting. So in many ways, I've seen a raised critical consciousness around these issues, despite the hysteria and often the distortion that occurs around my work and even my own life.
When you give somebody your credit card, you know, when you're making a purchase and they see your name, what kind of reactions do you get to your name now?
I've not quite reached that level of infamy, I must say. That would be interesting. I would say generally the people who recognize me tend to be people who are affirmed by the work and therefore affirming of me in turn. Seldom do I encounter folks who recognize me or recognize my name. And those I find often who have even castigated me in editorials and speeches and so forth have never even seen the work, which is to me a constant source of amazement that one can judge so harshly a piece of work as well as one who has created it without ever actually analyzing what the content, the specific and real content is there. And it says to me over and over again how much homophobia infuses so much of the political debate around these issues of control and cultural work and cultural expression.
Have you written any grant applications, applied for funding lately?
Oh, yes. I've, in fact, received a large grant for a documentary project on African-American identity and how we as black Americans have represented, understood, seen, defined, expressed what it means to be black. So I have received funding, and in fact, even when Tongues Untied was first receiving its attention as this so-called pornographic work, I had submitted a grant to the NEA for the present project, Color Adjustment, and was very clear to them about Tongues Untied, what it was, that I had received an indirect NEA grant, and there might be some controversy because of this, but I wanted them to know I wasn't going to hide this work as I wasn't going to hide any of the facts of my life. And they said, send it. We know about it anyway. And I did receive the grant from the NEA for this work, Color Adjustment, as well.
So you don't think that the controversy around Tongues Untied has hurt your ability to get your work funded?
Well, I mean, it depends upon in what context. I know if I submitted anything today to the NEA, I doubt, seriously, that I would be considered, mm-hmm. no matter what mm-hmm. merits the project might have. I know that, in fact, for a project in which my name was submitted on the application to the National Endowment for the Humanities, the project was turned down, and one of the comments from one of the panelists was that Marlon Riggs is, quote, an extremist who is not to be trusted. And this was for a very scholarly work on issues of Jim Crow in American life. There was no, in any way, I think, taboo subject matter being dealt with here. This was racism. If anything, this country has learned to at least discuss racism, if not resolve the issues and divisions that surround racism. And yet, in that kind of work, too, my name has become a lightning rod of a certain kind of opinion that's considered subversive and extreme.
Are you proud to have that position, you know, of being a lightning rod?
I'm not proud of being considered a pornographer. I know what I am, and I know what the intent and the actuality of my work is about. But I think it, you know, is outrageous at times to see one's name and life, career, one's entire total humanity being discredited and dismissed by these easy, catchy labels of pornographer or obscene smut monger or left-wing, politically correct lunatic. And it, again, shows to me how rabid some of the conservatives in our society have become and attempting to assert or reassert their control over all matters of life, not only that of business and politics, but equally important culture.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Marlon Riggs. Let's talk about a couple of the ways your work has been used as a symbol by people on the right. Now, Pat Buchanan used an excerpt of Tongues Untied in an ad against Bush in Buchanan's presidential campaign. And this was to illustrate the message that Bush, quote, enlisted our tax dollars in pornographic and blasphemous art too shocking to show. I'll confess I haven't seen this ad. I've just read about it.
That was a height of absurdity. Bush being portrayed as a patron of homoerotic art. I mean, you know, the mind recoils at the contradictions that are contained there. And yet the stupidity, I think, of a campaign that believed that this kind of propaganda would work and that, you know, Americans, whether in the South or elsewhere, were gullible enough to believe this, to buy it, for me, simply is almost unimaginable. And I was disheartened not simply by Pat Buchanan's use of the excerpt from Tongues Untied, which, mind you, did not even deal with the true subject matter of Tongues Untied, which is about black gay life. The excerpted material in that ad was of white gay men, the only small section you saw in the entire documentary. So even there, we were once again erased and rendered invisible, even in a work that was designed to empower and affirm our lives as black gay men.
Now, Jesse Helms and Robert Dole, both senators, cited Tongues Untied as an example of the left-wing bias of public television. What was your response to that?
I mean, at some point, you simply have to laugh, because what we're dealing with here is an attempt to simply say that we exist. We are Americans. We are taxpayers, too. We are part of family. In fact, we're often part of your families. And if that's left-wing, then and one can therefore dismiss that reality because of that, we're all engaging in this massive denial in which we simply don't have to deal with reality. And it was very clear to me what they were doing, that they were trying to use this work to rein in all of these various institutions, now public broadcasting, since the NEA had been effectively gutted. But now public broadcasting in such a way that if it could not be wholly dismantled and defunded, at least it would be brought into control so that the right kinds of opinions and values, namely those that are exemplified in so-called traditional conservative values, would be constantly propagated across the air.
My guess is that you might be a little ambivalent about public television yourself, but for opposite reasons.
Yes. I mean, I think been a number of critics who have challenged the increasing and I think very destructive corporate influence in underwriting and public television, the reliance upon membership dollars to finance programming, and with that, the kind of status quo programming that occurs when you cannot take risks, when you cannot do anything that's that particularly innovative and therefore potentially alienating of those sponsors. And one can look at the face of public television and see in so much just something that's plainly disappointing at times when it's reruns of Lawrence Welk or, you know, or replays of Hollywood retrospectives. You think that public television should be designed to do something a bit more challenging than that.
My guest is Marlon Riggs, and last year his film Tongues Untied about gay black men was broadcast on public television, on many public television stations as part of the series POV. Monday night, POV will present a new movie of his called Color Adjustment about representations of blacks on TV. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Marlon Riggs is my guest. Your new movie on POV coming up Monday is called Color Adjustment. It's about images of blacks on TV, the history of black characters on television. How important was that to you growing up? You know, turning on the TV and seeing other black people or not seeing other black people.
I mean, as a child, you know, watching television, I don't think I thought in any conscious way, oh, this is important and this is not important, or I like the Lone Ranger and Batman, but or I don't like them enough because they don't have black people. I think, like many people watching television, gravitated toward images that offered some measure of reflection of myself. And when I watched shows like I Spy and Julia, Mod Squad, Room 222. These shows were extremely heartwarming to me in that gut-level way in which many of us watch television and have something affirmed in us without critically thinking about what it is that's being affirmed. And as a child, I think, confronting a television that, by and large, was devoid of images, particularly of black children, Julia was extremely pleasant to watch. And I can only describe it in that way. It was like sitting down with family members or, you know, at that age going to church, because then I would see all my friends. Well, when I watched Little Corey, I sat down and I was engaged with his stories as much as I was with any of my friends at school, because on some level, he was very much real to me.
You interviewed a lot of the people behind the scenes of these TV shows, producers, directors, actors. Is there anything that you found out that really surprised you by talking to the people who made the TV shows in question?
Well, the people that I interviewed generally were, if you will, the progressive wing of Hollywood. And I think that really has to be taken into consideration in critiquing what they have to say. These were not the dogs. These were not the people who did not give a damn about what goes on except to ask whether it's making a buck. These are the people who are really concerned to some degree about issues of race and racial progress and how television might benefit that social project. And what for me was in many ways disheartening was to see the absence of any real critical interrogation about the assumptions of what progress means and what racial harmony means. Over and over again, when talking with the various producers, their television utopia was one in which race was essentially stripped away so that, as they said, we would be in this colorblind society where you would not notice that I was black and you were white. But what that said to me is that all of what for me has been beneficial about being black, all of which has been distinctive empowerment, would also have to be erased. And none of them seemed at all conscious of that. In their notions of what to do with television around race.
Were all the writers, directors, producers who you came across for the shows with black characters in it, were all of the behind-the-scenes people white?
Mostly so. I mean, obviously with Tim Reid's Frank's Place, there were a number of black writers for that. And I think, you know, in some of the other shows, particularly in some of the Norman Lear shows, there were a few black writers. But by and large, producers, creators, directors, writers for most of the shows were white and or Jewish.
What do you make of that?
Oh, we're entering dynamite territory here. I didn't obviously get into that, but I think that has obviously led to a lot of friction between blacks and Jews in particular, in the sense of feeling a deep sense of betrayal, in that people, a community that has been through suffering and has been portrayed in such a way to make that suffering seem justified, would now do the same to black Americans and be indifferent to that kind of treatment of black Americans really enrages many blacks. And there is within, I think, Hollywood a great degree of friction and tension within these two ethnic communities, between these two ethnic communities. We don't deal with that overtly in color adjustment. I think we're more interested in issues of representation and power and identity. But there is definitely a sore point there.
You didn't deal with it because it was too dynamite, maybe?
Not too dynamite, but that was another documentary, quite frankly.
Right, right.
I mean, you know, this is the piece that could go in so many different directions, as you can imagine, and there's so many shows that could have been dealt with and weren't. And to some degree, we had to find a focus, which became eventually the family and constructions of the family in prime time. And how we were, that is, black Americans, were assimilated into that mythic family. But given that, a number of other kinds of issues, as well as all kinds of other shows and series, dropped by the wayside.
Did any of the shows that you screened while making the program look really different than you had remembered from when you watched them in their own time?
I can't remember watching Amos and Andy except vaguely, and I know I must have seen it in syndication because I wasn't born when it first aired in 1951 through 53. But I know in watching it later, doing research for the documentary, I couldn't help at times but break out in just gut-level laughter because it was so funny. And I was prepared to absolutely loathe the show. I was sure there would be nothing redemptive about it and that I would simply have to almost hold my nose and keep from vomiting and watching these so-called racist caricatures done by the white man. I mean, it was sort of all of my, you know, issues I thought about to come out about this show. And watching it, I couldn't help but feel pleasure at times in the brilliance of the performances and at times also the brilliance in the writing. And that if that show were set against all kinds of other shows that depicted blacks at that time, and even now, I think it might have been acceptable because it was the only one, and the only one that in many ways affirmed a very status quo view of blacks as inferior and buffoonish. It came under attack, and I believe justifiably so.
Your movie, your documentary ends with The Cosby Show. What do you think of Rock?
We didn't obviously include Rock in the documentary. In fact, Rock came after we had finished shooting as well as editing. But Rock is an interesting show in that I think it tries to move us beyond, in some ways, the conventions of black situation comedy and television. I mean, I was amazed, for instance, when the program dealt with homosexuality. And it was something, for instance, I don't think one ever saw in The Cosby Show or one has seen in much of primetime depictions of black families. At the same time, this is a family which truly believes in the American dream. And even though it is a working class family, their aspirations really conform to much of what we think about working class people and their desire to be part of the mainstream, to own a home, to live successfully. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing in itself wrong with having those kinds of values. But when those become the only values by which one judges success, by which one judges achievement in life, then something becomes, I think, extremely fascistic about the values. Anyone that differs and therefore is labeled as deviant gets excluded, not only from the medium that is television, but also often in society.
The Rock show that you're, the Rock episode that you're referring to, where I think it's the father's brother.
Exactly. Played by Richard Roundtree, of all people, Shaft.
It was quite an evolution. Well, he's bringing his lover home, and it's kind of like, okay, he explains to the family it's a man, and then they open up the door, and it's a white man.
Yes, even so. So we really are getting into taboo territory here.
You know, I'm thinking if you ever decided to do a movie about images of black homosexuals on network dramas and sitcoms, it would be a real short show.
It would be over in about 10 minutes. That would not be a documentary, true. That would be a brief essay,
a short.
Yes, yes.
Do you watch a lot of TV now?
I don't watch as much as I used to as a kid, obviously because in part I'm producing television.
Yeah.
But also, I mean, at times I'm simply bored. I watch a lot of television these days more to see what's going on and to see what's evolving in the medium. But I can't say many of the shows give me pleasure as such. It's partly simply as, I think, someone who believes in the importance of popular culture that I watch it so that I can chart how television is dealing with all of the ills that oppress us in this society.
Have your parents been supportive of you through the controversy?
My whole family has been wonderful. I mean, in some ways, in the way many black families deal with adversity, and particularly with issues of sexuality, I can't say that we've talked a great deal around a lot of this, but they have been there, and at times just have been there to hold my hand, to be at screenings, to offer their support, to say that they're proud of me. From my sister, who is almost half my age, to my grandmother, who called me up one day and said, I just listened to this radio show in which they were talking about Tongues Untied, and some woman said she saw two men kissing on the air, and she couldn't believe it because she needs a good man, and there were a fine black man right there. And my grandmother said, some people are so silly, but it was her way of saying that my life was okay. In an indirect fashion, which I have come to accept as part and parcel of our culture. But my family has been wonderful with all of the work. And they know, again, the complexity of who I am, and they're not suckered in by these labels that have been put out by the right.
I can imagine how hard it would be on some parents to deal with this, parents who might be a little uncomfortable at finding out that a son or daughter is homosexual, and then having, like, senators speaking out against them because of it. Gosh.
But, I mean, I am so much of who I am because of my elders, because of my parents and my grandparents, and also because of simply the elders in my neighborhood where I grew up, in which there was constantly the assertion of you have to be who you have to be, mm-hmm. And you have to be that despite what others might think and say of you. And I mean, I don't know if they knew that I would take it to task in the way that I have mm-hmm. around these issues of sexuality as well, but I think that kind of affirmation has been critical and has been there constantly throughout all of the struggles around what I now do and who I now am.
Well, Marlon Riggs, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Do you know what your next project's going to be?
Oh, yes. It's a documentary that's funded by the ITVS, the Independent Television Service, which Jesse Helms wanted to defund.
Mm-hmm.
It's about African-American identity. It's called Black Is, Black Ain't.
And you're just starting on that now?
We're shooting it right now. We should be finished, hopefully, in January, February.
Okay. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Marlon Riggs' new documentary, Color Adjustment, will be shown Monday night on the PBS series POV. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. At 24, Francisco Goldman returned to Guatemala, where he was born, to write love stories set in New York. But when he got there, he found he couldn't ignore the brutal reality of the military regime in power. He became a political journalist and filed from war fronts throughout Central America. Coming up, we'll talk to Goldman about death squads and machismo. His first novel has just been published. Also, in these days of massive cutbacks, linguist Jeff Nunberg talks about the creative euphemisms corporations have come up with to fire employees without ever having to say, "You're fired." That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Bosnia, Serbian batteries in the hills around Sarajevo have resumed shelling of the city despite a unilateral ceasefire. This could appear to cast doubt on a good-faith negotiating effort and complicates UN efforts to reopen the airport. Pierre Vickery reports.
The renewed bombardment of Sarajevo came within hours of a pledge by the leader of the Serbian Democratic Party, Radovan Karadzic, that the time had come to seek a resolution to the catastrophic war in Bosnia-Herzegovina. Bosnian radio reported heavy Serbian shelling of almost all parts of Sarajevo, saying nine people had been killed and dozens wounded as shooting and explosions reverberated around the city. Heavy fighting was also reported in other parts of the republic, and Croatian radio said Yugoslav warplanes bombed targets near Bosanski Brod and Derventa. But Herzegovina was reported to be quiet following yesterday's capture by Bosnian forces of Serbian artillery positions in the hills around Mostar. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
President Bush told world leaders at the Earth Summit in Rio today that he did not go to that meeting to apologize, and he proposed another gathering this year to deal with global warming. Mr. Bush has been criticized by other nations for weakening a global warming treaty and not signing a treaty on biological diversity. In a short speech, the president cited several actions the U.S. is taking to cut greenhouse emissions linked to the Earth's warming trend. Members of the European community have promised $4 billion more to aid in environmental projects, but Mr. Bush said Americans' record on environmental protection is second to none. Vice President Dan Quayle launched an attack today on likely independent presidential candidate Ross Perot. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The vice president, speaking to a conservative lawyers group, said Perot had tapped into a deep well of frustration in the country, but is what Quayle called a false solution to the problem of a deadlocked government. The vice president also attacked Perot for suggesting that Japan and Germany are doing better economically because they have newer constitutions than does the U.S.
It would be a serious mistake to replace a genuine statesman with a temperamental tycoon who has contempt for the Constitution of the United States.
Perot has been leading or closely trailing the president in recent polls. The Bush campaign has been grappling over how best to respond to Perot's appeal and now seems to have settled on Quayle to lead the charge. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 3 points to close at 3,354.36 on volume of over 181 million shares. This is NPR News. In Washington, the U.S. Supreme Court, in a 7-2 ruling, has limited the right of environments to sue in connection with overseas projects that are said to threaten endangered species. The ruling is seen as a victory for the Bush administration and overturned a ruling in favor of wildlife groups that sought to aid endangered species outside of U.S. borders. Dissenting in the ruling were Justices Blackmun and O'Connor. The last Western hostages held in Lebanon may be closer to being set free. German diplomats are to travel to Syria this weekend for the possible release of two German aid workers held in Lebanon for more than 3 years. The two are believed to be held by the elder brother of two men jailed in Germany on terrorist charges. Oliver Rielinger filed this report for the BBC.
This Sunday, a senior German government official, Mr. Bernd Schmidbauer, will go to Damascus, and speaking in Rio de Janeiro, where he is with the German delegation for the Earth Summit, Mr. Schmidbauer said the chances looked good that he would be able to take the hostages with him back to Germany. A spokesman for the German government said there were assurances that Heinrich Ströbig and Thomas Kempner would soon be free, but he didn't specify a date. The spokesman rejected reports published earlier this week by an Israeli newspaper that the German government had promised ransom money and the release of the two Hamadi brothers to the kidnappers. He said Bonn had made no concessions. The spokesman said he believed that Iran and other countries in the Middle East had realized that it was in the interest of their relations with Germany to press for a release of the hostages.
Oliver Rielinger in Berlin. Officials of the Food and Drug Administration say that they found signs of insects and rodents in 23 out of 35 inspections on board Amtrak passenger trains in the first 3 months of the year. A spokeswoman for Amtrak says these problems were not found in the food itself, but mostly behind the scenes. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. You can guess by Francisco Goldman's name that he's from a mixed heritage. His mother is from the Guatemalan aristocracy, his father a Jewish American. Goldman spent the first years of his life in Guatemala and grew up in a suburb of Boston. He's traveled throughout Latin America, reporting on civil wars for such magazines as Esquire and Harper's. He's a contributing editor of Harper's. Goldman's first novel has just been published. It's called The Long Night of White Chickens. It's a semi-autobiographical story about a young man's return to Guatemala, where he confronts the brutality of a military regime. Goldman returned to Guatemala as an aspiring young writer in his early 20s.
I was a fiction writer, and I wanted to, you know, be a fiction writer. And I was living here in New York and trying to, you know, having a very hard time providing myself with the time to write, because I was always just trying to pay the rent. And so I remembered that we had a chalet down in Guatemala, family chalet. I said, I know, if I can just make $1,000, I'm sure I can live there for a year and I'll be able to write. And of course, I was very sort of apolitical and didn't know anything about anything. And so I got down there and was astonished to find out a war was going on, and that, in fact, the town where we had our chalet had been overrun by guerrillas and the police force had been wiped out. And so I couldn't stay in the chalet. And I ended up living in my uncle's house. I think I was like 22, 23 years old. And that ended up being, you know, the beginning of a 10-year immersion.
When you started returning on your own to Guatemala and you were becoming more politically aware, did your family's privilege start to make you uncomfortable?
Very much so. Very much so. There were all kinds of, but it's a, you know, it's an extraordinary thing about Latin American families. I mean, for better or worse, because sometimes it makes us seem kind of insincere or something, family does come before politics. You know, this is the favorite famous example of the Chamorro family in Nicaragua, where you have, Doña Violeta is the president, and she has the two Sandinista children and the two anti-Sandinista children, but they get together and have dinner every Sunday, and nobody ever talks about politics. And I think I always wonder how much my family knows about what I write and all that, and what my opinions are. And it's just extraordinary how, in that very affectionate, playful Latin American way, it's sort of never alluded to, you know, except now and then in a joke, you know. For instance, when my cousin's ranch got taken over by guerrillas, somebody caustically said, that they were surprised that they hadn't seen me there among them.
You know? How did that joke make you feel?
You just laughed, you know. Guatemalans, I think the thing that's gotten them through all the horrors that they've had to endure the last 10, 30 years has been a fabulous, ironic, dark sense of humor that they all have.
Yeah. When you started going to Guatemala on your own in around 84, earlier than that?
Well, that was
early
then,
80s.
Yeah, that was 1980.
Okay. This was a very repressive period. Can you sketch out for us the kind of disappearances and death squad murders that were happening then?
Well, back then, that was under the Lucas regime. I mean, the way this slowly, you know, crept into my awareness, because, I mean, the amazing thing about Guatemala and why, you know, metaphor throughout the book asks, does Guatemala exist, is it is so extraordinary how the most appalling things can be going on, right under your nose, and you won't necessarily be aware of it. And if you want to ignore it, you can, because people who disappear don't make any noise, you know. And it just slowly began to, you know, I remember just slowly you began to feel this, like, incredible fear, you know, especially among young people. You know, you just would walk down the street, and if somebody just getting out of a parked car, you'd see, like, whoever was closest to that car jump in fear, you know, because you never know. And the thing that most, that was the sort of, you know, most shocking event that I remember, you know, that sort of really woke me up with a bang was the famous Spanish Embassy fire, which was just down the block from where I, you know, was living in my uncle's house, you know, working on my New York City love stories. And that was when suddenly, you know, 48 Indian protesters came down from El Quiché, led by the famous Rigoberto Menchú's father, who, of course, I'd never heard of then, and nobody had. And they were protesting, you know, the massacres and the repression and the land seizures in El Quiché. And in order to, you know, gain the ear of the international community, they sort of went and asked for at least temporary asylum in the Spanish embassy. Now, of course, embassies are neutral ground, and local police forces aren't allowed there, but the Guatemalan army and police stormed the Spanish embassy, and 48 people died. I mean, everybody died. I think there was one survivor, a young Indian, and he was dragged from his hospital bed that night and murdered and thrown onto the university campus. And suddenly, you know, there I was, and, you know, why were these people down from Quiché, and what were they protesting, and what massacres, and my God, you know. And, of course, at that point, you just couldn't ignore what was going on.
My guest is journalist and novelist Francisco Goldman. His new novel is The Long Night of White Chickens. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Francisco Goldman. Authoritarian regimes really know how to use fear to manipulate people. And I know when you've lived in Guatemala, you've seen the effects of fear on people who you're close to. Can you talk about that a little bit, watching people react differently to fear?
Fear in Guatemala, especially during the really bad years, it became, you know, the very air you breathed, and people would react differently to it. But it has all kinds of effects. I mean, one of the things about it, it makes you very melancholy inside. You know, it's really sad to be walking around being afraid of being killed all the time. You know, and I think that melancholy becomes such a weight that people either, you know, seem very melancholy, or it engenders this kind of hyperactive, also kind of franticness, as if they're always trying to, like, lift off from it, you know. It's where you get, like, a very, you know, a lot of, like, sort of frenetic humor comes out of it. And, of course, it has all kinds of incredibly negative effects on people, and that makes people suspicious and frightened of each other, and or it forces people into all kinds of forms of denial is another common thing. You know, people walk around, you know, pretending nothing's going on, and, you know, or forces a kind of heartlessness on people. You notice people get numbed, you know. There used to be such outrage sometimes at certain crimes, but they become repeated so often that, you know, people just shrug and go, oh, again. Oh, so, they massacred a bunch of pregnant ladies again, you know.
What did it do to you?
Well, during the very worst times, it, first of all, just made me impossible to be around. I, especially when I would come back to the United States, I was sort of obsessed, you know, and I was obsessed and very, very angry. When I was in Guatemala, during the periods where for various reasons I had reason to be just frightened whether they were actually going to do anything to me or not, I began to sort of waste away. I really did go from 165 pounds to 130 pounds in a matter of like 6 months, and had a tick under my eye, and very much like Roger does in the book, I did have a bottle alarm system set up so that if anybody tried to come in through the house, they'd just knock over a bottle. I remember when I got back to New York after that period, when I finally got out of Guatemala, my very first night back, I fell asleep and my subletter was still in the next room and they broke a glass on the floor and I woke out of bed in a flash and ran to where my window would have been in Guatemala and, of course, hit the wall face first because there was no window there, you know, and fell back, you know, onto the floor.
How close did you come to being a victim of government repression?
Oh, you know,
Did they know about you?
Yeah, I don't think that, you know, I think they wondered what I was doing there before they, you know, I really started to do journalism. At one point, there was a very prominent, wonderful journalist and photojournalist named Jean Marie Simon who was living in my house. We were very good friends. And a death squad did do a fake assassination on us. Of course, we didn't know it was fake till you know, it seemed very real. And the way we got away from that was by, you know, I mean, there they were in a Cherokee, you know, pulling out their weapons. And miraculously, a bus went between where they were and where we were. And we ran along using the bus as a shield and jumped on the bus. And we thought we'd escaped very heroically. But when I went to the embassy the next day, they knew about it. And I remember the consul said to me, they could have splattered you all over the sidewalk like tomato sauce if they'd wanted to. That was what we call a heavy-handed tale, meant to send a message.
If you're just joining us, my guest is novelist and journalist Francisco Goldman. His new novel, his first, is called The Long Night of White Chickens. What's it been like for you to be exposed to a more Latin macho style of manhood? than probably what you were used to from the Boston.
Well, actually, the Boston Irish Catholic was its own kind of macho, and in some ways more macho.
Uh-huh.
Actually, though, in a sense of being disingenuous, it's sometimes terrifying. I remember I've always had this incredible problem where because I'm sort of mestizo-ish looking to the average Guatemalan, I'm not a European-looking Guatemalan, that whenever I'm in Guatemala City with you know, a girlfriend, they immediately think they have to try and, you know, hit on her. And once that woman shows that she's not interested, they feel very insulted that, you know, she might be with a darker Guatemalan. They never see me as an American. And so I'm constantly having to wiggle out of fist fights and big, you know, macho shows down there. It gets kind of dangerous sometimes.
How do you get out of it?
Well, when I'm lucky, the bartender comes over and protects me and says, leave him alone or we'll call the police. Or once I remember they just, you know, guys pulling up their shirts and showing me their pistols. So they sat there and sneeringly insulted me and my girlfriend who turned them down. So she had to pick me up and sort of walk me out of the restaurant while I was, you know, rigid. Another time I actually did fight back, I have to admit, and he was so drunk that I won. And the next day when I went in, this was my big macho moment. You know, the beer we have down there is called gallo beer, which means rooster. And the waiter came up and put a free gallo beer in front of me and said, un gallo para el gallo.
Oh, so do you think it's funny, or are you really embarrassed by having to get the bartender to protect you or your girlfriend?
I'm mortified.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I mean, I just went down with, I'm trying to stay away from those bars from now on. Another time, there was another kind of macho in those very same places. It happened to be the bar all the mercenaries hung out in. I think it was because this was, you know, the Contra War was still going on. And this bar was actually called the, I think Soldier of Fortune magazine called it the, the main networking place for mercenaries in Central America. I remember one night I very indiscreetly said to somebody, you know, mercenarios son basura, mercenaries are trash. And I thought I had said it softly to some Guatemalan girl who I thought was being overly impressed by them. And this mercenary heard me And I thought he was going to kill me. He turned around and he put his face right next to mine. And he was screaming at me to come out and fight with him. And finally I said, no, I am not going to go out and fight with you. And he went, why not, you chicken? And I said, no, because you'll kill me. And he stood back and he just let out with this roaring laugh and said, that's the smartest thing you've said, buddy. And after that, he thought he was my pal. And every time I'd walk in there, he'd come and sit with me and act like we were. And I remember when my mother came down to visit me in Guatemala, I took her in there and introduced her to him. And she couldn't believe it. Here I was introducing her to these southern, Tennessee mercenary soldiers with their green beret T-shirts and stuff.
In just a couple of seconds, because that's all the time we have, what's Guatemala like now when you go there?
Very sad. I mean, we were just there. I just came back from Guatemala a few weeks ago. There's a lot of interesting things going on. But, 87% of the population is living below what the UN defines as a poverty line. That top 13% is just getting richer and richer. It's displaced Panama, it seems, as a drug transshipment point. You see lots of, like you used to in Panama City, money laundering sorts of banks springing up. But at the same time, the human rights violations are also continuing. There's a few noble efforts to resist that. I think you've probably heard the story of the American nun Diana Ortiz, who was abducted and raped and tortured in Guatemala and miraculously escaped. And she has very bravely gone down to Guatemala to try and press charges. And they're having what they would like to be a mock show trial. And they're trying to completely discredit her, but she is brilliantly and bravely persisting in trying to, get the truth out. And also, I think a very important thing to remember about Guatemala, particularly in this year, 1992, is that it is 60% Maya. And for all the things that are going to be said about the conquest and everything this year, there's a country where, despite having enduring, every horror and attempt to conquer them, the Mayas have survived and are really ready to, become 21st century Native Americans and have a very strong culture. And if there's anything positive about Guatemala, it is just that.
Francisco Goldman, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Francisco Goldman is the author of the new novel, The Long Night of White Chickens, published by Atlantic Monthly Press. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. Today we hear from General Lou McKenzie. He's the Canadian officer who's in charge of the Sarajevo sector of the UN peacekeeping operation, about what things are like in the Bosnian capital. We will also be hearing today from a Slovakian political leader about what kind of relationship people in Slovakia want with the Czechs. It doesn't appear at this point that Czechoslovakia, or the Federation of Czechs and Slovaks, is holding together very well. We'll also be talking with the rock duo They Might Be Giants about their new album called Apollo 18.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In the current economy, corporations seem to have found a new way to compete in finding euphemisms for putting people out of work. But linguist Jeff Nunberg says he has their number.
Mr. Dithers could allow himself the luxury of directness. Bumstead, you're fired. But nowadays, the axe is so muffled you can barely hear it fall. Bodies are stacking up all over the country, but nobody's actually been fired. One firm announced involuntary force reductions, while at another, the process was described as involuntary methodologies. A computer firm is doing focused reductions, while an oil company said they were managing down their staff resources. Bumstead, you're managed down. Actually, these are reasonably direct. Most corporations prefer not to mention jobs or people at all. It's easier to describe the process as a kind of physical fitness regime for the body corporate. Companies are restructured, repositioned, redeployed, downsized, right-shaped. Lean is a favorite word here, a new, leaner business division. It makes you think of Scottie Pippen or some Olympic middle-distance runner, not the emaciated guy caging spare change at the corner. Now, there have been slang words for discharging somebody since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. Fired itself dates from the late 19th century as a pun on discharged, as in the gun was fired, the gun was discharged. But these words are mostly jocular. They're the graveyard humor of the people at the pointy end of the boot. It's only in recent years that employers have begun to feel the need for ingenious euphemisms. Of course, it's tempting to personalize the indignation that this kind of talk arouses. It's like the movie Roger and Me. You want to think that it reflects a rising tide of insincerity and deviousness. But this is hard to credit, just like the theory that people somehow got greedier sometime in the early 80s. The fact is that jargon like this isn't usually an individual transgression. It's what happens when the system itself begins to talk. If there's an invisible hand that manages the marketplace, there sometimes seems to be an invisible mouth that speaks for it. So put yourself in the place of some speechwriter sitting in corporate communications trying to put the best face on things. You simply can't say, well, business is really terrible and we're going to have to can 5,000 people. In the first place, the union would be on your neck if you use that kind of language. And you can't use layoffs either, because this time the jobs are gone for good. There's a lot at stake in the niceties. Remember that this is a country where it's illegal to fire striking workers, but perfectly okay to hire permanent replacements for them. Then, too, the stock analysts reading your announcement are going to be listening closely for any note of moroseness. Besides, it isn't 100% certain that anybody's actually going to be fired. After all, you're not getting rid of workers, just jobs. You could get lucky. Maybe typhus will break out and kill so many workers that nobody will actually have to be given the sack. Corporate language is like the corporation itself, a device for limiting individual responsibility. Except that both of them tend to leak when the weather gets heavy. Last year's jargon doesn't quite conceal the reality, so the euphemisms get increasingly more strained and defensive. When a company talks about involuntary force reductions or managing down staff resources, you can't help thinking they're trying to repress something. Not that they're worried about the workers catching on. They'll know the score when Friday rolls around. But the managers, the board, the bankers, well, the decisions are a little easier to live with if you don't have to think of yourself as putting people out on the street. That's what makes modern corporations different from Mr. Dither's little office. It's nothing personal, and they're doing all they can to keep it that way.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist associated with Stanford University and the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Fresh Air's senior producer today was Fred Landerl. Thad Kirk, Audrey Voblaitis, and Richard Parker are our engineers this week. Roberta Shurrock directs the show, with assistance today from Sue Spolin. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Andrea Sankar. She's a medical anthropologist whose experiences taking care of her dying mother at home led her to research how and why other families are choosing to take their loved ones home to die. She's the author of the book Dying at Home, A Family Guide for Caregiving. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
At Marlboro. The forecast overnight mostly